We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and FM 90.9 HD2. You'll find us online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. This afternoon, we're going to take a look at the life, work, and impact on the law of Antonin Scalia. Our guest is the legal affairs correspondent for USA Today, Joan Biskupic. She is the author most recently of American Original, The Life and Constitution of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. In this book, readers will find a portrait of the man, proudly conservative in his view of what is known as originalism. He's also known for his combativeness and charm. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Scalia have had a long friendship, and she has said of him, "I love him, but sometimes I'd like to strangle him." For this first biography of Scalia, Joan Biskupic conducted more than 100 interviews, including interviews with Justice Scalia. Listeners, you can join our discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments. I look forward to your telephone calls. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Joan Biskupic holds a law degree from Georgetown University. Before joining USA Today, she was Supreme Court reporter for The Washington Post and legal affairs writer for Congressional Quarterly. In addition to American Original, she is the author of a biography of former Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. American Original is published by Sarah Crichton Books, a division of Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. Joan Biskupic, welcome. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks, Celeste.
The title of the book, American Original, refers in part to Scalia's judicial philosophy of originalism. What is originalism?
It's a legal approach, and all sorts of justices and judges, lower court judges, have different approaches that they take to the law to guide them. Most are much more pragmatic than originalism, but Justice Scalia believes that a jurist should go back and look at the Constitution as it was drafted and as it was understood at its original time. So he goes back and looks at the context and essentially says, I'm going to look at the text of the document and of the amendments and how it was understood by its drafters. Sort of the opposite of what William Brennan, the great liberal, was known for, and what current Justice Stephen Breyer is known for, a more pragmatic approach that treats the Constitution as an evolving, living document that would meet society's needs at any point.
Yeah, how does he see this opposing view that as the nation evolves, the meanings held within the articles and amendments of the Constitution evolve with it?
What he says is, if you want societal change, if you want government to address the needs of where we are now as a nation, do it legislatively. Let the elected branches tend to that, not the appointed judges. And Justice Breyer, who, as I said, takes the opposite view, says, it can't all be left to the legislature. And the truth of the matter is, according to folks like Justice Breyer and other liberals, is that any kind of approach leaves room for your own ideology, your own politics, and you can't just say, I'm going to look only at the text. All judges bring something else to it. Justice Scalia defends his approach by saying, it's the purest approach. It's the pure to look at what the original drafters wanted, and Justice Breyer says, don't kid yourself, pal. You're bringing your own conservatism to it.
How else do you see Scalia as an American original?
Well, his first-generation Italian immigrant story informed that title also. As you know, Celeste, his father came here from Sicily as a young teenager, knew no English, went on to then get a PhD at Columbia University, raised his son as an only child in a first-generation household. In fact, I had always known that Justice Scalia was an only child who went on to have 9 children himself, but he was also the only offspring of his generation. And, you know, there you are in Illinois with a lot of families who are, you know, might have grown up in first-generation households. Just think of these two striving families that produced this one son who was such the center of attention for not just his own parents, but all these aunts and uncles.
Yeah. This was a telling anecdote that you include in the book. His father had a disappointment in his career at Brooklyn College, and his son said he turned to physical labor as a balm. He told you, Scalia says, it was his only form of exercise. He did not play any sports. I don't think he would like a sport. It was wasting time. This was productive.
I love that story. And, you know, you're the first person to ask me about that one. And you're talking about the fact that the father actually built these stone steps on his property by hand. He laid these steps in day and night, and that became his physical activity. And I went to that locale just outside Trenton, and there are those little stone steps in place that sort of satisfied the father at a time of great disappointment, and long after the father has died, when his son is now 73 years old, those little stone steps are still in place. The father wasn't interested in really any kind of extracurriculars in life. He was a PhD and taught Romance languages at Brooklyn College. And what you were referring to in terms of disappointment was that the father had wanted to become chairman of the department and was turned down and felt some bitterness about that. And the father also was a very serious man, did not abide any kind of silliness, and just sort of was a reserved fellow who, in some ways, contrasted with the mother side of the family that was much more fun-loving, into sales and into politics. And this father, though, really influenced the son and actually made the son feel that he might not be able to measure up at some points.
Hmm. What was his childhood like?
Well, first of all, as I said, he was an only child. It was a very ethnic family in terms of the Italian-American life. His grandparents, the justice's grandparents, spoke only Italian, but he himself didn't learn Italian. And that was another thing he said he felt he disappointed his father in not learning Italian. It was a very strict Catholic family also. He was born in Trenton and lived in a little row house in downtown Trenton until he was about 5. And then the family moved to Queens, to the Elmhurst area, if any of your listeners know that part of Queens. And he, the justice, really very much more appreciated the New York world than the New Jersey world.
You report that in high school, Xavier High School, his academic prowess was established, his rule-oriented nature was reinforced, and his regard for Catholicism was entrenched. How important is Catholicism in terms of who Antonin Scalia is?
Well, I was struck by the fact at Xavier High School, which is in New York, in Manhattan, run by the Jesuits, that Antonin Scalia would have been singled out as an exemplary Catholic. I read a couple articles that were praising him as being an honor student. He became first in his class. He was a real standout in many, many ways, but he also was a standout in terms of his Catholicism, and he was conspicuous in his religious devotion, and that became a very much of an defining part of his identity. He told me this very neat anecdote from his time at Georgetown University, also Jesuit, where he was doing his kind of a thesis, his history thesis, and he had to come before a faculty committee of 3 individuals, and one person on the committee asked him what was the most important thing he had learned while he was at Georgetown, and about history, and the the justice said, you know, I was thinking, I can't go wrong on this answer. It could be something from World War II. It could be the Battle of Waterloo. You know, what could be the most important historical event? And the Jesuit who was leading this little committee said, no, Mr. Scalia, the Incarnation. That is the most important event that you should remember from your time here. And the justice himself said that was a lesson he learned at Georgetown, not to separate his intellectual life from his religious life, because they are not separate.
And what about his life as a jurist?
You mean in terms of how religion might affect him? Is that what you're referring to?
Yes, exactly.
Yes, well, here's the interesting thing about that. He is very serious about his religion. He happily will talk about being a Roman Catholic, but what he says in terms of how it influences him as a judge is that it does not. And he says it's because he's a textualist, an originalist. He's going to read the words of the document, the Constitution or federal laws, and he says that's a way to ensure that his religious views or any other kind of personal views don't come in. Now, as you know from reading the book, there's a lot of criticism over whether that's exactly true, but that's how he defends himself. And he says, you know, I have very strong views on things like religion and personal moral preferences, but they do not affect my work as a judge.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Today we're talking with legal affairs correspondent for USA Today, Joan Biskupic. She's the author most recently of American Original, The Life and Constitution of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. At Georgetown, he was very successful. He was valedictorian for the class of 1957. Now, he was then at Georgetown when the court decided Brown. Did he give the case thought at that point in 1954?
I don't know if at that point it had resonated with him as much as it did in later years when he was a law student at Harvard and then certainly a law professor and then a judge. He grew up in a fairly sheltered area, mostly other Italian and Irish immigrants. He said of his own father that he doubted that his father had met a black man until he was, you know, very far along into adulthood. And I think I don't know if he thought, I will presume that he thought segregation was wrong, but I did not ask him that question specifically. On Brown v. Board of Education, unlike with Roe v. Wade, he's not trying to go backwards. Now, as you know, Celeste, he's very much against things like affirmative action or racial remedies that address long-time discrimination against African Americans or that try to address bringing more diversity to any kind of public setting, whether it be a college, university, or the workplace. He's so adamant against those kinds of group remedies. And it's quite a strong passion of his, that opposition. But in terms of Brown v. Board of Education, which first got rid of separate but equal and began the long, difficult process of school integration, he is not arguing to go back. Now, I am sure that he does not like how that opinion was written in terms of looking at the social consequences of segregation on young students. But that is one battle he's not willing to fight the way he's willing to fight something like Roe versus Wade.
Yeah. So how does this jive, though, with his philosophy of originalism?
That is an excellent question, because the truth is that when you look back to post-Civil War amendments that brought equality into the Constitution, you could say, as you know, just a standard matter, that there was not supposed to be any more discrimination against black people in America. But the people who wrote those amendments and our whole country was all geared towards segregation then. Obviously, we were a very segregated country, and Justice Scalia always says that you don't look only at the text of the Constitution or amendments, but you look at what was going on at the time. And if you are a pure originalist, arguably, you might believe that segregation should still exist. Now, he isn't saying that, but I'm just saying that his approach to the originalism legal theory is that you don't just look at what the drafters of the Constitution or the amendments wrote, but also what their what their world was like at the time. And we know what our segregated world in America was.
The prologue tells a story of the justice speaking to the Federalist Society, a very friendly audience, and the time has come for one last question, and he ducks it. I don't know if you've got the book in front of you there. It pops up on page 9. I thought that was a fascinating question that came at the end of this talk and how he handled it.
I love that. In fact, you'd be interested to know this, that I went through several different versions of a prologue. I couldn't figure out how I really wanted to open this book. And I, you know, tried different ways that I thought would set a tone. And I went to the Federalist Society meeting last November. It would have been November of 08. And I knew he'd be there, and I knew he was going to be on stage. And I thought, maybe something will happen that will set the stage for what I'm saying in this book. And he delivered. He, as you know, he's up there. He's in his element. He's before a bunch of conservative lawyers and law students, and he gets very friendly questions from all of the audience. But then he gets this tricky question, and again, it's still a friendly audience. And I thought the question that he ducked went right to the key question of his work. And just so your listeners know what it was about, he was asked about his differing opinions in two disputes. One is a 1995 United States versus Lopez, and the other was the 2005 Gonzalez versus Raich. In the first case, the majority, including Scalia, voted to overturn a federal statute that tried to regulate guns near local schools, saying this was a state issue, not a federal issue. The case 10 years later, though, Scalia was in the dissent, voting against a majority opinion that said that federal drug law could not interfere with California policy allowing marijuana for medical purposes. And the questioner at this Federalist Society meeting is essentially saying, how can you vote to forbid the federal government to interfere with, intervene at all in a state regulation of handguns near schools, but let it override state choices about drug laws? And in fact, Justice O'Connor, when she was still on the court during the 2005 case, had said those two opinions are irreconcilable of Justice Scalia's. And Justice Clarence Thomas also disagreed. He's also an originalist. And here, again, at this friendly audience with the Federalist Society, Scalia has really been in his element. He's on. He's up. He gets the question about how that kind of inconsistent thought in those two cases. And what does he say but get another question? And as I write in the book, it has the feel of get over it, which is his line about Bush v. Gore when audiences still ask him about that. And because the audience is so in his camp, everybody just laughs and lets him go on to another question. And the moderator says, okay, so what's your favorite opera? Which, of course, he loves to answer that. I then asked him, Celeste, about the differences in those two cases, and he was somewhat defensive, but he said, look, the federal government has long restricted drugs, and I thought that in the case of drug use that the government would have been right to come in and say that states cannot allow marijuana for medical purposes. This is not inconsistent.
How many times were you able to interview Antonin Scalia?
About a dozen times, tape recorded. He started this project saying that he would not sit for interviews, but it helped me to actually do a lot of research into his family, into his early years in the Nixon and Ford administrations, that I went back to him sort of trading information for information from him.
That was very interesting, that period of the 70s, very interesting, and now in the post-9/11 world, also interesting, and I hope we'll get to that in a moment here. But I want to go back to the question you mentioned earlier, Bush v. Gore. He was so critical in that case, and you say it reinforced and defined his public persona. What role did he play? Take us back to that time, and how has that decision reinforced and defined him publicly?
Okay, just to remind everyone, it was a 5-4 decision with the more conservative justices prevailing, stopping the Florida recounts at a critical moment in the election between George W. Bush and then Vice President Al Gore. But what Scalia did to set himself apart from the other conservatives was write a special statement on the Saturday that the recounts in Florida were actually shut down. Initially, it was just temporarily, and then it became permanently. And the justices, by a 5-4 vote, said that they were going to stay or postpone the effect of a Florida Supreme Court ruling that had said the counting could continue in this disputed election of 2000. And Scalia wrote a separate statement explaining why they were shutting these down. Now, the interesting thing was that he wrote it alone. Nobody joined it at all. He wanted to explain why, before the Florida counties had even completed a day of recounts, you know, remember, everything's going back and forth, you know, how close was it, that the Supreme Court of the United States was intervening in the state situation and saying, no, all the Florida recounts had to be stopped. And what Justice Scalia wrote was that letting the recounts continue would threaten the legitimacy of Bush's election. And it sort of laid bare the political implications of everything in a way that, as I said, none of his colleagues who were in the majority wanting the recounts stopped joined. And it was essentially what he was saying is, if Bush were to win the presidency, which it looked like the majority was interested in Bush winning the presidency, through a court judgment, that the recounts would possibly undermine that, especially if the recounts ended up favoring Gore. So it was almost revealing some of the politics of it, even though, you know, I think everybody felt that politics were certainly in the air at the Supreme Court. But the fact that he had written this statement and talked about the importance of the legitimacy of then Texas Governor Bush prevailing and not having any kind of question about the continued recounts really put him in the center of this. And, you know, remember when this was. This was 2000. Chief Justice Rehnquist, certainly more senior. It didn't seem like Scalia would play that strong of a role, but suddenly he was thrust to the forefront, and it was a role that he embraced at the time, but now, as you know, Celeste, he complains that he gets more flack than anyone else for Bush v. Gore.
Yeah, it's interesting that on the one hand he can be so outspoken, and then the next moment he's like, get over it, let's go to another question.
That's right. That's right. In some ways, he wants it both ways. He wants the attention when he wants the attention, but then if you persist, he acts like, well, this just isn't fair. In fact, I talked to him in our interviews about Bush v. Gore, and he says, oh, gee, I take most of the heat for that case. And he does, but he seems surprised that he does when he put himself out there.
Does he have any regrets? Did you talk about that in terms of decisions that he's had a hand in?
He is so consistent. He has not voiced any regrets to me. And unlike my earlier subject, Sandra Day O'Connor, who really did change over her 2 decades on the court and who obviously moved more to the left and just started having a different approach to cases and possibly did have some regrets, but again, she was somebody who always liked to move forward. He's been very consistent in terms of what he wants from the law, his approach to the law, and never voiced any regrets to me about his decisions. And even when I questioned him on some of his more impolitic statements from the bench or when he was out talking to students where he would get in trouble for things he said, he never backed down from those and, in fact, got even more vigorous in some of his points and his total lack of political correctness.
Mm. We'll talk about that, too, I suspect, here as we go on. Let me reintroduce our guest this afternoon. Joan Biskupic is our guest today. She's legal affairs correspondent for USA Today, the author most recently of American Original, The Life and Constitution of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's take a call from a listener waiting for us in Champaign County on line one. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Just as a thought experiment, to test whether it'll never go anywhere, but to test Scalia about his Catholicism and his law being separate. If somebody were to send a suit up the circuit courts and all of the courts, and it would got appellates and would get to him. If somebody said that the Catholic bishops are a nonprofit organization and shouldn't be lobbying for about anything but to do with health care legislation, I wonder how he would actually rule on it. But that's obviously not going to go anywhere.
Right.
There's nobody going to originate that lawsuit, I don't think. I seem to have some plaster dust in my throat all of a sudden. What I wanted to ask about refusal of recusal, as I've been thinking about it, because I know there have been a couple of cases where he really had ties to people in the case and he refused to recuse. I'm trying to remember if it was he or Thomas or both of them that had, vis-a-vis Bush v. Gore, had significant relations to somebody that would benefit from Bush being elected, and that actually might be a case of recusal. I seem to remember something about that, although those many years ago. But I'm wondering if you could remind us, if you did look into the way he's just also deflected the apparent obligation to recuse himself in a couple of circumstances.
Those are both good questions. And just to remind listeners of the two matters, I'll take them chronologically because the one that really came to a head was the one with Dick Cheney and his case. But just to close out the chapter on Bush v. Gore, it did come up potential conflicts of interest for him. And in fact, in this way, his two eldest sons, Eugene and John, were lawyers associated with Bush's side of the case. Eugene Scalia, his eldest son, was a partner at the firm that Ted Olson was at. And remember, Ted Olson was the man who argued the case on behalf of George W. Bush, and then once Bush won, became the Solicitor General of the United States. John Scalia, the next son, also a lawyer, had signed a contract for a job with a Miami firm that was also representing Bush. So those two connections were there. Nobody formally asked him to recuse. There was a lot of talk about the sons, and then some columnists wrote about the fact that, you know, well, maybe he even would like to be Chief Justice, so he could be helping this Republican in. So there were those more subtle criticisms. The more direct one is the one you're probably remembering more vividly, and that's when Justice Scalia went duck hunting with Vice President Dick Cheney around the time that Dick Cheney's case was before the Supreme Court. This was in 2004. They had gone down to southern Louisiana. As you know, Scalia's an enthusiastic hunter. And in this case, there was a formal motion for him to take himself off the case filed by the folks who were in the dispute with Dick Cheney. This was this had to do with the Bush Energy Task Force, as you probably remember, that was favoring the energy industry, and critics of this task force had sued to get information about who was on the task force and to get accountings of their minutes and things. And it ended up going all the way to the Supreme Court. And since Dick Cheney had been a key figure in the task force and was being asked to release papers related to the Energy Task Force's work, he was a critical player in it. And the court had already agreed to take the case when Vice President Cheney and Scalia went on this trip. And one of the environmentalist groups, I believe it was the Sierra Group, had officially asked that Scalia sit off. And he said, no way. And he wrote a very lengthy statement about how, look, justices and members of the administration have always done things socially. That doesn't mean that they're not that the justices wouldn't be impartial. And he provided a lot of history about former justices and administration officials palling around and made the whole thing look a little bit like a good old boy network. But he also said, "Look, I'm not going to recuse. And if you think it's I can be bought as cheap as a trip down to Louisiana with the vice president, the nation is in deeper trouble than I imagined."
Well, I'm sure it wasn't. Obviously, one isn't talking about being bought. It's just a matter of the appearance of collusion or something.
That's exactly right. And it's so interesting you mentioned the appearance there, because the Sierra Club, which was, you know, one of the parties that was fighting Cheney and the records, said, look at all the editorials, look at all the cartoonists, look at all the comics that have cited this instance, and how can it be other than an appearance of you know, kind of a paleship that could influence the case?
It was actually Judicial Watch, which is a relatively right-wing organization that started that one.
Yes, Judicial Watch.
That's the one that had the maps of Iraq supposedly being looked at and stuff before that implicated planning for reordering the oil fields of that area. Anyway, that's a little digression thing.
No, but you're right. Judicial Watch and Sierra Club had sued the vice president over the task force issue, but it was only the Sierra Club that then asked for the recusal.
Yeah. I want to follow up on this listener's line of questioning regarding Dick Cheney. Scalia's association with Dick Cheney goes all the way back to the mid-1970s. In 1974, Scalia became an assistant attorney general in the Department of Justice, and this was just a few days after the resignation of Richard Nixon. And this brought him into the company of not only Dick Cheney, but Donald Rumsfeld and others. How did this period shape Scalia's views of government and the law?
This was very, very determinative, because think of what was going on between the executive branch and Congress in these months right after Watergate. A lot of tension. Scalia was one person who kind of thrived on this and wanted to further assert more interest in executive privilege. He was not deterred by the events of Watergate. He really felt that the president had authority to withhold information in many, many situations, and became the voice and face of the Ford administration then later in 74 and 75, testifying before Congress and trying to withhold documents. He also really fought amendments to the Freedom of Information Act. He really believed that it was misused by the press and the public, and really was someone who was not cowed by the events after Watergate, and neither was Dick Cheney. The two of them were like-minded in some ways, looking at the rest of the world as, you know, either with them or against them. He said of Dick Cheney that they weren't really close friends, but that they were friendly in those years. And Justice Scalia said, he knew I was on the right team.
Hmm. Is this chapter, do you end with something like, you're either with us or you're against us?
I refer to the justice's tenure after Watergate as providing him with an unusual lens through which he would continue to see the ways of the nation's capital. You know, almost he would always be suspicious of the press, which certainly was the post-Watergate era for the executive branch. He grew more suspicious of the press, more condescending toward Congress. He's never really understood the ways of Congress or appreciated them. And then I say, what you might be remembering, Celeste, is I say, and along with others in the executive branch fraternity of the 70s, most conspicuously Dick Cheney, he would come to adopt a very clear attitude: you're either with us or against us.
Mm. Well, let's move from the turmoil of that period to the turmoil, that followed September 11th. What has been his position on the right of prisoners, foreign detainees, or U.S. citizens held on terror charges and their legal status?
Okay. He actually distinguishes prisoners between those who happen to be foreigners and those who are American citizens. For foreigners, which has been the bulk of the cases that have come from before the Supreme Court, no rights. No rights for Guantanamo detainees at all, and he's been quite adamant about that. But he did vote in a separate case, one of the early cases that the court had arising from the post-September 11th backdrop, that U.S. citizens, I don't know if you remember the case of a man named Hamdi, U.S. citizens, his name was Yasser Hamdi. He was an American citizen who was born in Louisiana and grew up in Saudi Arabia, and he was captured with Taliban fighters on the Afghan battlefield in late 2001. His case was one of the first cases to come before the Supreme Court, and in that case, Justice Scalia actually had a more, I guess, so-called liberal point of view by saying that this man is a U.S. citizen. He shouldn't be held without charges and a trial. He ends up dissenting in that opinion that was kind of a compromise opinion that Justice O'Connor wrote. And he dissents with some unlikely pals, Justices Souter, Ginsburg, and Stevens. And while Justices Souter and Ginsburg really focused on the lack of statutory authority for the detention of this Mr. Hamdi, Scalia and Stevens contended that U.S. citizens could never be indefinitely detained as enemy combatants unless Congress formally suspends the writ of habeas corpus. Now, again, Celeste, this is for U.S. citizens who would be caught up in the war on terrorism. For foreign detainees, which, again, have been most of the sorts of cases we've seen before the Supreme Court, no rights, no right to habeas corpus, which is the way prisoners can challenge their detention.
Yeah. So a very different view in a case, the case involving Saleed Ahmed Hamdan.
Correct.
He was a Yemeni.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, he was on the losing side in Hamdan's case, as you know, and then he was on the losing side of other Guantanamo detainees' cases. And he was so strong from the bench about these, where he would dissent and say, you know, people will die because of these rulings. And Justice Stevens said to me, you know, I think that's pretty unwise that he's saying it. First of all, he didn't believe it was true, but he also thought the rhetoric was hot enough that it shouldn't have been expressed that way. And I went back and pressed Justice Scalia about his controversial assertion that people would die because of some of these rulings that favored detainees. They didn't, you know, these rulings didn't let anybody go free. It just allowed them to go before a judge. And Justice Scalia, you know, rejected my questioning and said, it's obvious, it's inevitable that people would die. And his line to me was, if you let loose, because of more rigid procedural requirements, dangerous people who are going to go back to the field, you are undoubtedly placing lives at risk, undoubtedly.
Hmm. This goes back, this next question goes back to originalism. It's interesting to read about how he thinks about torture in light of recent events going back to 2001. In light of the Constitution's barring of cruel and unusual punishment, he has some interesting things to say about torture and interrogation.
You know, that's exactly right, and that got him in trouble when he was, the BBC had picked it up, and I forget what the circumstances were when he was first asked about this. But his view, okay, the Eighth Amendment, as you said, bans cruel and unusual punishment. Now, Justice Scalia has been asked about torture, and what he has said is torture isn't punishment. Now, this is a very formalistic approach to this, but he's saying, look, I'm not saying I'm in favor of torture. I'm just saying that torture is not punishment. It's separate, so it's not governed by the same prohibition from the Eighth Amendment as imprisonment would be. And he made that clear when he was over in London and thought he was kind of giving this sort of easy interview with somebody from the BBC, and that ended up making a lot of news here in America when he said the thing about torture not being subject to the cruel and unusual punishment prohibition. He also, when he was up in Canada, said something about how you know, Jack Bauer is one of his heroes from the TV drama 24, and I guess if Jack Bauer can torture, you know, other people might be able to torture.
Yeah. In my introduction, I mentioned Justice Ginsburg and her comment, I love him, but sometimes I'd like to strangle him. What are his relationships like with his colleagues on the court?
They're actually quite collegial. They've all come to accept him, and I think Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg embodies that in a lot of ways. As you know, they socialize, they go to the opera, they travel overseas together. They spend every New Year's Eve together at the Ginsburg's Watergate apartment. Ginsburg's husband, Marty, is quite the cook, and sometimes he'll fix something for the meal that Justice Scalia has shot. So they're obviously, Justice Scalia and Justice Ginsburg, very different on the law, but they've they somehow appreciate each other. I actually think it has to do with the fact that they're both former law professors. They're from the Northeast. They get each other. They really get each other, and they're both very intellectual. He has a good relationship with most of the others. You know, Justice John Paul Stevens, who's the opposite of him on the law, too, Justice Stevens being from Chicago and quite liberal, says, look, I think that he doesn't need to say some of the things he says in opinions, but he's been very influential. In some ways he's been constructive, but in other ways he has been not very constructive. So Justice Stevens will be a critic of his, but he enjoys him. They all sort of get along. You know, they're appointed for life, so there's an incentive to try to get along. And Justice Thomas isn't a close pal of his, and mostly likes to point out the differences between the two, because obviously they're always seen as voting together on the law. But Justice Thomas says, look, I'm the kind of guy who likes to go home and watch the Nebraska Cornhuskers on TV. I don't think Justice Scalia ever watches football on TV. Justice Scalia really gets into the enterprise of deciding cases. He turns on his computer. He puts on his music. He thinks he's conducting a symphony. I basically come here, do my job, and go home.
Mm. Has Scalia read American Original?
Well, I don't know. I presume he has looked at it enough, because who wouldn't, right?
Right?
Somebody writes a whole book on you, don't you think you're a little curious?
Oh, yeah.
So I don't kid myself that he's, you know, he's made no time for it. I sent him a copy of it out of courtesy right away, and about a week later he was invited to an event that was sort of celebrating the book, and he actually came to that event, and he kiddingly said to me when he got into the court police car as he was leaving, he said, I'll read it, or I'll read the rest of it, and we'll talk. I haven't heard anything through the grapevine about what he might actually feel. I think there are probably some things he doesn't like, but I've really tried to be fair to him as much as I really tried to mostly give really good information to my readers.
Yeah. At the close of the book, one of the things you say about him is that he's finding new influence among his colleagues. Would you talk a little bit about that?
It's so true, Celeste, because of who his colleagues now are. When I started this book, it was before George W. Bush had made his two appointments, Chief Justice John Roberts and Associate Justice Samuel Alito. Those two men, when they were younger, when they were young lawyers in the Reagan administration and the first Bush administration, really looked up to Justice Scalia as a legal thinker. And they went on to be quite independent individuals, and both became appeals court judges and then were appointed to the Supreme Court. But they already were sort of thinking along the lines of Justice Scalia, not as far to the right and not as interested in the whole originalism point of view, but they're people after his heart. And he's certainly given, those two men have given Justice Scalia more votes than he has had in the past. And he's getting more and more majority opinions to write and more significant opinions to write. And you referred to the end of the book, and I use the D.C. guns case where the Supreme Court for the first time found a Second Amendment individual right to bear arms. And Justice Scalia wrote that opinion and had the majority of the court for it. And it was Chief Justice John Roberts who assigned that opinion to him. And that case was made possible through the addition of both the Chief and Justice Alito.
Mm. One last question here. There are a couple of cases, as I understand it, before the court that challenge a favorite tool of prosecutors in corruption cases. And I know that as you have spent a fair amount of time in Illinois growing up, that you might have an eye out for these cases as well, as our former governor, Rod Blagojevich, prepares to stand trial next year, and as George Ryan, a former governor, is in prison today. What do you think is in the cards for this prosecutorial tool?
That is a terrific question, and I believe that law is going down. If you had said during those oral arguments last week over this law that makes it a crime for a public official or a corporate executive to deprive of honest, to deprive either his constituents or his shareholders of honest services, you would think the law was in trouble too, because the problem is that law is so open-ended. And for years, lower court judges have struggled with how to interpret it. And the federal government says, look, there's been enough clarity in those rulings. There's enough context there around what could be seen as ambiguous words, there's enough clarity and context to know what this law is about. That's what the U.S. Justice Department vigorously argues. But easily a majority of those justices were finding problems with how vague it could be and how it could be manipulated. And actually, Justice Scalia himself said that that law has become a tool of prosecutors who want to stand up before the media and complain about things. Now, in terms of your various governors there, Governor Ryan was convicted on other things beyond honest services, but you're actually right that that was one of the main offenses. And with his successor, Governor Blagojevich, he also, that kind of the centerpiece of his earlier set of charges from, what was it, like April of this year, Celeste? When was he? I think it was earlier in the spring, right?
Yeah, well, yeah. He was arrested a year ago this month. He was indicted then several months later.
Okay, so I think in the spring of this year, of calendar year 09, the Pat Fitzgerald indictment, I believe, I'm almost positive, had as its centerpiece the honest services fraud law. Now, this is all part of fraud. It's an anti-fraud law, but this provision is aimed at offenses that would go beyond property and money, and as I say, the deprivation of honest services. It's been on the book for more than 20 years. But the problem is that it's been subject to so much varying interpretation, and as I said, a majority of the court seems very troubled by it.
Yeah, there we have to leave it. We're out of time. Joan Biskupic, thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste.
Joan is the most recently the author of American Original, The Life and Constitution of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. And for those of you in the Chicago area, next Tuesday, December 15th, 2009, she'll be at Anderson's Bookshop for a reading and signing at 7 o'clock in the evening.